Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We're going to stick, Matt and myself, with the markets, kind of continue the conversation that we just started off with Scarlett and Romaine. We do have the Fed's preferred measure of U.S. inflation cooling in May. Consumer spending stagnated, suggesting the economy's main engine is starting to lose some momentum. Meantime, euro area core inflation reaccelerated in June. That's a setback for the ECB. And you've got the latest PMI numbers out of China showing that economy's growth momentum slowing further. It's a lot of moving parts globally. So to our eco chat we go. Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent Michael McKee on the phone in New York City, and then on Zoom in New York City, Apollo Global Management Chief Economist and Partner Torsten Slot. Great to have you two gents here with us. Mike, kick it off with us, though. When you look at the numbers, good inflation data, weak consumer spending data, I don't know. What's the really important points here today?
Well, I think the shocking news is that when you raise interest rates, the economy slows as inflation starts to go down. The Fed is having an effect. We saw personal spending rise just a tenth of a percent in the month of May. We'd seen some weakness in there. And we saw reasonably good news, put it that way, on the PCE inflation numbers. The headline number in particular, up only a tenth. The core was up three-tenths. So there's still room to go, but we're starting to see some progress be made. And that's reflected in the numbers we got later in the day. The sentiment numbers were all up for the University of Michigan. So people are maybe feeling a little bit better about the economy.
Torsten, let me bring you in here and also tell you, I have actually created a Slock button on my Bloomberg terminal, so I can hit it at any time and pull up the charts that you send me. They're really invaluable. So I want to just express my thanks for that. How do you see the Fed right now? Because it seems to me that everybody we talk to, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but they don't believe that Powell is going to hike two more times. And especially when we see PCE coming down, UMISH expectations going out 1 year coming down pretty significantly, it doesn't seem that the Fed is necessarily going to have a reason to hike.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the issue is that the market is certainly of the belief that the Fed will not do much more. Strictly speaking, Fed Fund futures are still pricing one more hike here in July. But I think the data today, and to what Mike just said, I mean, 4.6 year over year on core PCE. We were also at 4.6 in December. So as Jay Powell highlighted at the last press conference, they have not made progress as getting inflation down towards 2%. I completely understand there's a lot of issues and debates about what's happening to the shelter, the housing component of inflation that may roll off a little bit. But now with housing recovering, well, we may then see some reversal later on. So I think that the Fed would look at core inflation, which is an important part for them, and say, well, if that's at roughly 4.6, and that's where it was 6 months ago, we just cannot stop hiking rates, and we at least need to keep rates at these levels, as he said at the press conference, for a couple of years. So the bottom line, Matt, to your point is that, yes, I understand. Headline is coming down. The UMISH short term also was coming down. But core inflation is not really making much progress at this point. It is still moving sideways. And I think the Fed is telling us that we need all to take that more seriously.
But can inflation continue to rise when A, I mean, consumer expectations are down, B, there's a lot of talk about household excess savings being gone. I mean, you sent me the Fed paper from last week that showed they think there are no more excess savings in this system. And if we start to lose some jobs, people aren't going to have the money to spend to support inflation.
Certainly. But as you know, none of that really has happened at this point. We're still looking at, if I look at my Bloomberg terminal and look at what expectations are to non-farm payroll next week, is 225,000. That's not a bad number. So if that's the case, the Fed will look at that and say we got 39,000 jobs created in April. If we get 225,000 in the month of June, then of course the conclusion would be that the economy is just not slowing down as quickly as they would like. And with that backdrop, it makes sense that they remain hawkish. I completely agree that once the labor market starts cracking, that meaning falling apart, and we see the unemployment rate going up, then they will probably change their tone and talk about the other side of the dual mandate, namely the labor market. But that's not where we are at the moment. So it makes complete sense. Also in Sintra earlier this week, that they keep on being hawkish.
I want to bring Mike back into the conversation. Mike, while we're talking about U.S. consumption, what's interesting is there was our Bloomberg Economics team putting out a story basically that the bulls are wrong to take comfort in solid spending. Basically, they're saying how bulls often say, hey, there's strong consumption. That means things are okay. And that the U.S. economy is nowhere near a recession. But what they basically say is that you don't start to see consumer spending slow down until we're actually in a recession. And that some measures of consumption are more important, like durable goods. Weigh in here on when you look at some of the personal consumption numbers, what's really, really important and what the Fed probably pays attention to.
Well, the Fed's paying attention to overall consumer spending, not on a data point by data point basis. They want to know that the economy is still seeing some strength. Now, it's true, as the economics people pointed out, that real spending has been lower after you adjust for inflation. It has been lower. It hasn't been anything to write home about. Still, it's been relatively positive, and we don't know whether it'll start coming back or not. Maybe people take a breather, but I don't think that the Fed is too worried at this point about the consumer. They do think that spending is going to slow, that things are going to go according to their plan, essentially. But at this point, there's nothing that would cause them to think that they need to take any other action other than what is in the markets of at least one rate move and probably two.
So, Mike, just to follow in terms of what's going on inside the Fed, are they really unanimous in their thought? And I bring it up, right? They had a unanimous vote for that June pause. At least that's what came out. But you've got, Rafael Bostic basically saying, we're done. And I understand he's, a non-voting member. But is there more tension inside the Fed that maybe says things could play out differently depending on the data come the next couple of meetings?
Sure. There are people who are on the much more dovish side. One of the more dovish people, Austin Goolsbee, has deferred his decision on what he's going to do, saying he hasn't made up his mind yet. But he leans towards the dovish side. And I think they could have a split vote if we see inflation staying where it is or coming down just a little bit, but not enough, and consumer spending remaining strong enough, because there are others, Mickey Bowman, who has made a lot of comments about the economy being too strong and more needs to be done. We haven't seen a dissent from a board member since 2005, but one could imagine that she would, and possibly some others.
Hey, Torsten, I want to ask a question that I've got coming in from a listener. What level in unemployment breaks the consumer? We were talking about that and the broader economy. Higher unemployment means stress in credit card, real estate, services spending. And we've seen, certainly, credit card usage jump and delinquencies start to rise as well, even before student loan debt kicks back in.
Absolutely. And that, so just on your final point, absolutely. What's really unique is that, think about it, the unemployment rate is essentially still at the lowest level in 50 years. And we are already seeing delinquency rates going up for credit cards, for auto loans. We're beginning to see the weekly data for bankruptcies for companies also beginning to move higher. So why are all these things already starting to slow down even before the unemployment rate has moved up? So I would take all that combined and answer your question by saying that, well, at least the Fed says that in the long run, the unemployment rate that we need to go above is roughly 4.5. Mm-hmm. And given where we are 3.7, that means that we have several months ahead of us where the labor market needs to weaken before the Fed will begin to say, okay, enough is enough. Jay Powell, again, in Central in Portugal earlier this week, very clearly said, we need the labor market to soften, which is another way of saying we need the unemployment rate to go up. And we have not really seen the unemployment rate go up meaningfully. And we that at least, in my view, 1 percentage point from here before we'll begin to see a more meaningful slowdown in the broader economy.
All right, guys, we got to run. Thank you so much. Torsten Slok, Chief Economist and Partner over at Apollo Global Management on Zoom in New York City. And our thanks, of course, to our own Michael McKee, International Economics and Policy Correspondent at Bloomberg, joining us on the phone in New York City.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
I want to get to some other news that certainly caught my attention on the Bloomberg today. The SEC pushing back against a wave of filings by asset managers to launch the first U.S. exchange-traded fund ETF that invests directly in Bitcoin. Matt, they said the applications lack clarity and further information is needed before they are considered for approval.
Yes, but they're going to get that. I think I saw that NASDAQ is going to go back, well as the SEBO. They're going to go back and refile, answer the questions that the SEC had. I am really stumped as to the problems that the SEC has with a spot Bitcoin ETF, because Bitcoin has been acknowledged even by Gary Gensler. It's a commodity, and there are a lot of ETFs that hold commodities, and there are a lot of commodities that are volatile, just like Bitcoin is volatile.
But so I think if
anybody could handle it, BlackRock and Fidelity probably could.
One would hope. So let's see what Timothy Tully has to say. He's CEO at the digital asset wallet Zelcor Technologies. He's on Zoom from Bethany Beach, Delaware. Tim, good to have you back. It's been a few months here. So what do you make of this?
Glad to be here. First of all, thank you. Busy Friday.
Yes.
Interesting. You know, 2 days ago, we were talking about the two of the world's largest asset managers, $15 trillion in assets, filing for spot ETFs, right? So, or the equivalent of five apples as of today, right? And so today, the SEC comes back and says, pushes back quickly, by the way, this pretty quick response under 10 days to the BlackRock filing, saying lack of information and lack of clarity, and they need more information, specifically some of the surveillance monitoring that BlackRock and Fidelity had proposed. So I think that's going to get ironed out. I actually think the quick response here is a good thing. I do think it's ironic that the SEC is saying that their quick read says this has a lack of clarity. It's choking with irony, but I think it really is.
It's almost like Gary Gensler's joking. Is this some kind of satire?
It certainly feels that way, doesn't it? But I think the reality is, I think we all know who the CEO of BlackRock is. He's an aggressive Democrat. He's plugged into what's going on. BlackRock's batting average, I think, is 575-1 for their ETF filings. They're going to win this one over time. The question is when it's going to happen. And I think for those of us in the crypto world, we kind of have mixed feelings, right? Because this is a really good thing, particularly for the mass adoption crowd who sees two bellwether companies that are going to offer access to Bitcoin price action in particular. And so I think that's great. I think that's great for crypto. It's going to be great for the broader crypto market. I think for me, as somebody who's been in traditional finance for a long time, the genesis for ETFs was to give everyone access to commodities in particular. Think about gold. Your average human couldn't store and hold gold. It's impossible to do that. So the ETFs were created. Blockchain technology is specifically designed to address that particular issue. So I think this is good short term. Long term, I hope we let the technology do its thing. But the other thing I think, and I'm sure many people have cited this in the news, but Bitcoin holders are, this is coming from somebody who's been in the equity world most of his career, right? Bitcoin holders are some of the longest holders 3 to 5 years of holding Bitcoin. So you've got a fixed supply of assets. You've got a long holding, you know, long hands holding Bitcoin. And then you've got these huge players coming in the market trying to buy up supply. Price can only go one direction when that happens, right? So it's going to be really interesting about the timing, how far in front of the timing the market is. But I think we're going to see some really positive price action of Bitcoin over time very quickly.
Well, you've got to have the trust. You've got to have the belief in the asset, right? And it does look like we've had it for 10 years and it's built up. Right now, or today, we hit an intraday high on Bitcoin as well. It was over $31,000. Hadn't been that high since June 7th, I think, of last year. And recall that it dropped precipitously in the period of a couple weeks last June. I wonder about, you know, my take on the crisis that we saw with FTX and the other exchanges was kind of serves you right for keeping your Bitcoin in their centralized exchange. Like, that's not the point of this asset. You're supposed to hold it yourself at home, you know, maybe, or wherever you like, but it's very easy to put in cold storage and keep it safe, right?
Absolutely.
I think we're going to see non-custodial exchanges really flourish after this.
Couldn't agree with you more, Matt. Obviously, my company is in the space of helping individuals buy, store, and manage their own crypto. So I think you're
absolutely
right.
What is your product,
right,
by the way? What is your wallet?
So we have a non-custodial solution. We've been around for 4 or 5 years, multi-platform, so you can get it on desktop and mobile and basically every platform that you can think of. We support over 70 blockchains, so we believe in the ethos of whatever you want to hold, you can hold it on our wallet. And we believe digital assets are here to stay, and we're spending a lot of time talking about crypto finance, but we really believe that crypto technology and all of insurance and real estate and tokenized assets like securities and other things, all those things will be digital assets that you'll want to store in custody yourself, and our solution will help you do that.
Well, Wall Street definitely is with you on most of that, probably not the custody part, but clearly even the big banks know it's all going towards tokenization.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I get that part of it. I guess I just still wonder that we're still figuring it out exactly what cryptocurrencies are.
It's only been since 2009, Carol.
I know, but I think considering what we saw over the last year, I think regulators are right to be cautious as they move forward.
Well, what do you think about that, Timothy? I mean, cautious, I get, but this seems like a little bit more than that.
And just got about 25, 30 seconds.
Yeah, it absolutely feels like there's a lot more going on there. I think everybody that's in the space believes we need to have regulation, but we need clarity ourselves, right? So what we're getting is a lack of clarity from the administration and the SEC. And what we're seeing is a lot of countries outside of the U.S. being more aggressive here. We want to be the innovation center for the world. We're going to need to get our stuff together here to make sure that people want to stay and develop in the United States.
All right. Timothy, thanks so much. Have a great weekend and a great holiday. Timothy Tully, CEO at the digital asset wallet Zelcore Technologies, joining us on Zoom from Bethany Beach, Delaware.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, women hold a third of S&P 500 board seats for the first time ever after scores of men gave up their directorships in May, a long elusive goal that's been touted as a baseline for lasting change. The threshold was passed during the peak season for annual meetings when many directors retire. Men, Matt, vacating four times as many seats than women. And this was according to a recent data compiled by our team here at Bloomberg, reported out by our Jeff Green. So we've seen a shift. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. You look...
That's just my face.
Perplexed. All right, well, let's get to it. We have a perfect guest. Carolyn Everson is board member of the Knot Worldwide, the global wedding marketplace. They operate in 16 countries. She's also board member at the Walt Disney Company, Under Armour. She is the president, a former president of Instacart, former VP of global business over at Meta, former corporate VP at Microsoft. We just wanted to lay it out, and she joins us on Zoom. You have an incredible, incredible background. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
Well, and I want to start with your background, because what is it, first of all, and we're going to get into corporate boards, and we want to talk about the business of the Knot, but you know, the media world, social media, or the evolving traditional media world, what do you find interesting and do you think should be watched by our audience?
Well, I think the thing that is constant is change. And it what I would say to the audience is lean into the change as much as possible, because the consumer in many ways is moving faster than even companies are. And this is, there's a tremendous need for transformation still in 2023. And that was even prior to the advent of AI that everyone is talking about. There were still many traditional companies that had to transform everything that they were doing. And now AI is further putting a further fine point on that and accelerating change even faster.
So, I mean, at the Knot, is any change still necessary? It seems like the business is very digital and very forward looking in terms of the way weddings are planned. I happen to know because I used the Knot to plan my wedding a couple of years ago.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, look, let me take a step back and just sort of set the context for the audience. The wedding industry is a $250 billion industry. It is extremely robust. 2022 was considered sort of the Super Bowl of weddings because there was such pent-up demand. We had 2.6 million I-dos in the United States alone. This year, it'll go back to pre-COVID levels at about 2.1 million. And the Knot have achieved its highest revenue in its history in 2022 with $400 million in revenue. And it's been profitable for 10 years. So it is a very strong business. And yet, one of the reasons why I joined the board is I think that we are going to go through a pretty massive transformation. When you think about the advent of AI and what it can do for wedding planning and allowing couples to speak in natural language and have the Knot be a real assistant to help them with their planning, I think it's going to be a phenomenal user experience. I think the data that we have to help our 850,000 vendors to serve their customers better is just going to get stronger and stronger as we utilize AI in our product development. So I'm very bullish about the opportunity. We currently operate in 16 countries. We've got a lot of growth globally. And also, it's a very nascent advertising business. And having been part of the team that helped build Meta's advertising business, I think there is a pretty significant opportunity for us to do that at the Knot.
What do you think, though, in terms of, you know, it's interesting that you went there in terms of advertising and Meta, the evolution of ads, maybe as a result of AI, is it going to change dramatically? Should we all be kind of ready for something very different?
I think so. I mean, I'm already seeing significant change. So when you think about the scale at which companies do advertising these days across digital platforms, AI has actually been utilized by companies like Meta and Google for years to get the right ad to the right person at the right time. So it's not like those companies just woke up and, you know, at the end of November 30th, when the world woke up to ChatGPT. AI is being utilized in tech companies for many years to make the advertising smarter. What I think you're going to see a big difference is in the creative development. What we're seeing now is using generative AI, marketers can literally put together thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of varieties of campaigns in a much more efficient and effective way. The Knot has been experimenting with some of that marketing, has already seen a 20% lift in conversion. So I think that's going to be a pretty transformational trend in digital advertising.
You talk about transformational, and boards are transforming. You are part of that. And I am curious, though, when you, in a week where we saw Supreme Court rulings dealing with affirmative action, you know, rejecting the use of race in university admissions, we've been talking about how does that maybe impact ultimately the business community? What are the conversations that boards or companies are having as we see these changes?
My experience through all the companies that I have the privilege of serving on is that they have an unwavering commitment to the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and that is not going to change. I think the goal is to have boardrooms represent a diverse set of individuals because that's the customer base that these companies are representing. And diversity comes in many, many forms. It can come certainly in gender and race, sexual orientation, but geography plays a factor in some of the boards. Experience, you know, you have to have certain levels of experience to be on the audit committee, for example. And so each search that I have been part of, either for myself or in looking at new colleagues that could potentially join the boards that I'm on, there are a lot of criteria that the board of directors goes through and really thinks about what skill set does the boardroom need in order to help advise management. And that can span many, many different areas. And I think that there is an unwavering commitment to making sure that boardrooms stay diverse, become more diverse, but with a big capital D, because diversity of thought can mean many different things.
Well, we've run out of time. I hope you will come back because there's many, many more things I would love to talk with you about, because I know you co-founded the Gun Safety Alliance, and I'm curious about, would you work with business leaders and citizens to prevent unnecessary gun deaths in the United States? But I do would love to dig deeper into kind of the role of corporate activism, if you will. So, Carolyn, I hope you'll come back soon. Carolyn Everson, board member at the Knot Worldwide, also on the Disney board and more, joining us on Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. Keep driving
you crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the day, the week, the quarter.
The Matt. Half.
And the half.
Yes.
Yeah, I forgot the half.
Well, you know, I would normally forget the half, too, except for that stat that the NASDAQ 100 has had the best half since, well, ever.
It's since
had
ever.
The best first half ever and the best 6 months since 1999, but it's just, I didn't even realize this was going to happen until this morning.
You're not alone. Many people got the call on the markets wrong. And I thought it was interesting what Scarlett said earlier, that here we are going into essentially a holiday weekend, right? It's going to be quiet. It's already kind of gotten quiet and people are buying into this rally. I think volume, though, I feel like it was a little bit lighter. But nonetheless, let's see what Ryan Kelly has to say. He's Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager at Hennessy Funds, co-manager of the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund, Midcap 30 as well, which has beat nearly all of its peers for 5 years and running. Returning on average about 11% annually, and the Hennessy Gas Utility Fund beating most of its peers too in the past year and month, up nearly 3% in the past 1 month. He joins us on Zoom from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hey, Ryan, nice to have you back. It's been a little while. This rally, especially from a handful of the big mega cap tech names and the NASDAQ outperformance, does it make sense to you?
Well, I mean, you know, you have to look at where we are over 2 years, and with, you know, the NASDAQ being down so significantly last year and then roaring back this year. I mean, overall, it's in a more normal range, I guess I'd say. So does it make sense? I mean, it seems a little bit fast for this year, a little bit aggressive. It's been driven by a lot of, you know, Future promises, the future promise of AI, you know, that's part of it. Although I really enjoy what you said earlier about your iPhone being basically a utility, right. Because that's true. I mean, when it comes to Apple, they're not being driven by the whole AI craze. They just continue to do, you know, $200 billion in sales every year. And what are you going to do with that? It's pretty amazing. So I don't think it's overdone. I think that probably in the second half of the year, you might see, you know, slowdown in some of those sectors that have really done exceptionally well. We've seen consumers do very well. Consumer discretionary has really outperformed this year, as well as the large cap tech names. It's a reversion to the mean. And I think that we probably would not expect a similar kind of experience next half of the year. But again, over 2 years, it's a little bit more normal over time.
Yes. I want to say thank you for adding that, for bringing us down to earth. Because, Ryan, I hadn't really even thought about that all day. I've just been wrapped up in the hype of, wow, what an incredible half that was. And wow, Apple's a $3 trillion company. And, you know, we're on a tear, you know, even into just today's trade. But you know, the high, we shouldn't forget, for the NASDAQ 100 at least, was at the end of 2021. And we came really clattering down last year. It was an awful year. And anybody who was even holding the cues, you know, took a huge hit last year compared to, you know, the gain that we've seen in the first half. They haven't come back from that. So I think it's great to get that perspective. What do you think happens as well when, you know, people start to rotate into fixed income? That's got to be a move, right? Especially with yields at this level. If you think the Fed's done, it looks like people are making that move, some of them today.
It's true. I mean, it's fixed income. It's high yields on anything that has a yield. In other words, we've seen that pretty significantly all last year, and then dramatically in the first quarter of this year, where people have been pulling money from the banks and moving it elsewhere. Now, you know, some of it's gone into the equity markets. A lot of it's probably gone into, you know, higher yielding money market funds. And when you get rates up at that level and the long-term return for, say, the Dow over 104 years, I should say, is close to 10%, and you can get 5.5% with very little risk, you know, it's compelling. But you know, overall, I think that money rotation is happening. But on the other hand, that's really what's also driving a lot of this outperformance of the stock market in general, and that's cash. People have a lot of cash to invest still. A lot of people who put their money in the bank to do nothing with it for many years now have opportunities to invest in equities or in fixed income, and you know, cash on balance sheets of companies. That makes the company stronger. They can reinvest in their own stock through buybacks. They can give back higher dividends. So there's, you know, cash continues to drive this higher as well.
All right. What's not really driving the market higher, at least here in 2023, are the energy names. It's the worst major industry group or worst performing group, major industry group in the S&P 500 out of 11. It's down about 7%. Now, mind you, it's after two blockbuster years where there was way out performance. But you guys have a fund where you have to think about utilities, gas utility in particular. So what is it? Where are you finding opportunities there?
Sure. Well, you know, we're finding opportunities in utilities because it's actually not as much. Well, it's not really dependent on the price of natural gas or the price of oil or the price of whatever input there is to create the energy. You know, these utilities like your iPhone, you use it every day. You have to use the energy. You know, you need that. And, you know, utilities make money by basically moving, in this case, natural gas through their pipelines to the end customer. So, you know, there's actually, believe it or not, a pretty significant opportunity in utilities. I understand utilities are defensives. Utilities pay a dividend. They have that, you know, nice downside protection. But if you look forward over, you know, many years and even many decades, this push towards the electrification of everything towards a cleaner energy future means that we need an incredible build out of the utility sector. And, you know, in our fund, we have about 50% of the fund is invested in electric and multi-utilities, which have both, you know, some natural gas components. Even the natural gas utilities, there's a lot of opportunity there as well as they continue to develop hydrogen, you know, renewable natural gas, et cetera. But this really, you know, and I have to give credit to some of your analysts at Bloomberg. They did an incredible job, especially in the Bloomberg New Energy Finance division. I'm going to read some of these numbers. It's going to take $196 trillion by 2050 to reach the goals that we need to get. It's going to take, you know, clean energy is 8 gigawatts of capacity now. It needs to go to 40. You know, we need to add 69 million miles of cable. So the way utilities work are when they invest in their business, when they invest in creating the grid, that means growth for the company and growth for earnings over time.
Well, great to get your perspective and also to bring us down to earth about the run-up that we've seen, certainly on the tech side of things. Tech stocks. Ryan Kelly, have a good weekend at Hennessy Funds. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.